like to speak a little bit about the pervasiveness of the destructive and malicious threats that have become an epidemic and deadly plague, luring and enticing the unwary to their demise. Paul's letters, according to Yahweh, and according to any historical review, are the deadliest of all time. Today, the religion that he contrived with his 13 debilitating epistles has become a worldwide epidemic, which is precisely what God said when he was talking about how the little horn would grow out of the dying Roman Empire to become the nastiest beast that the world had ever known, that beast would trample upon the whole world. Well, it is the largest worldwide epidemic ever. There are 2.3 billion Christians today, 1.2 billion of which are Roman Catholics, 900 million are Protestants, and just shy of 300 million are Orthodox. Now, this 2.3 billion, just to look at when God said, you know, at the end of all of this, when, you know, he finally says that that Babylon has fallen and that the whore of Babylon is no more, but that he is just the moment before that still trying to call his people out of Babylon, that if you go back just 100 years ago, that there were just 600 million Christians a century ago. 600 million a century ago. Today there are 2.3 billion. In fact, there are more people plagued with the Pauline pestilence today than in the preceding 19 centuries combined. 2.3 versus 2.1 billion. Christianity wouldn't claim 100 million souls until the 8th century. Another 500 million would be infected with Paul's poison pen by the conclusion of the 15th century. Over the next four centuries, culminating with the 19th centuries, Paul's letters would damn 900 million additional souls. Overall, 4.4 billion people have lost their souls as a direct result of the pathetic diatribe of one man, which is why Yahweh predicted of him, saying, "This soul, Shaul, is the plague of death." Words kill. So that's that is a sobering reminder that when Yahweh makes a prophecy, as he did in Daniel, he is precise. Yes, Jason.
I was going to say, you were speaking the other day when we were on BTR, and how a good friend of yours actually was, you know, trying to, you know, convince you not to investigate Paul.
Yeah. And, yeah. In fact, left me our friendship. We parted when I did. Yeah.
That's a snare as well.
Yes.
You know, and you may have lost a friend there, but like I just want to say he didn't, because you know you stayed true to like to the facts. You know, you're still being honest with him.
You know, it is a
but he said it's not for you.
Yeah, the challenge to actually view Paul with an open mind is about the most difficult thing one can do today. Now, I'd say almost. I still think that to intellectually, to rationally, to systematically and methodically expose and condemn Muhammad, Allah, and Islam based upon the words and deeds of Muhammad is the most difficult thing a person can do today. And
yeah.
And that's for two reasons. One is the material itself is so dark. It's so demented. It's so putrid that every day you spend in it, and I invested 10,000 hours in it, every moment you're in it is just nasty. But the second thing is that that the world, both Muslims who are vicious towards those who do so, and socialist secular humanists, which is, now, socialist secular humanism is the world's third most popular religion. You know, atheism, agnosticism, humanism, socialism, collectively, That's the world's third largest religion. They are also vicious. So I would say that, exposing and condemning Islam is the most difficult thing a person can do today. It is most prone to being enticed into a trap. But second to that would be exposing Christianity. You know, it's it is something that is extremely difficult to do. And it's one of the things that's difficult about it is the just the culture itself. You know, you're in an environment where it isn't even conceivable for most people that a man who is considered to be Saint Paul, who is the author of half of the Christian New Testament, could have been a fraud.
Yeah, you know, well, that's when the fear mechanism kicks in, I think.
Yes, it does.
You go back to a, you know, people think they're saved under that umbrella, and then, you know, when to consider it false kind of puts them back in a
undermines their foundation, undermines everything that they have believed, every nuance of their life is, you know, they're going to see their dearly departed in heaven again. They think it's not true. Oh my God! Then what?
Yeah, and he provides first fear of the Torah, and then he provides a shelter in his rubbish.
Yes,
and people become accustomed to it, and you know, unless you're actually looking for the truth and you want to know God, you want to have a relationship. You're probably not going to take that step.
No, and as I can tell you that as I started on the second book, the 91st Psalm I viewed as just God's affirmation that we would work together and that he would keep my home as a safe sanctuary. And exposing and condemning Islam. It turned out to be the same set of promises and the same method that we would use to expose Christianity. And it turned out that by coming to know the ploy that Muhammad used to hoodwink and beguile the first Muslims, that it turned out to be the same ploy that Paul used. These men are extraordinarily similar. Their testimony is extraordinarily similar. So, you know, when someone says, you know, the God of the Bible is the same as the God of the Quran, they're a nincompoop, because the God of the Bible is a terrible term, but it, you know, 80% of what's called the Bible is the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, and Yahweh and Allah are exact opposites. So you have to be a complete nincompoop to buy that. And then if you realize that, you know, in the Christian New Testament, and you have to take out Yahweh Kana, Montanyah, and Revelation, as being clearly the words and deeds of Yosha. But if you deal with the Pauline God and compare the Pauline God to the Quranic God, they're the same. They are the same. Satan is the Lord is both. Satan is one and the same. That part is absolutely true.
Well, Christians further have that end time. They know it's in the end times. Nobody that's stupid has read any prophecy. They know this has got to be it.
Yes.
But they also believe that anybody approaches you that tries to shake your faith, you know, which is never asked for, they think you're Satan in disguise.
Yeah, that is both the Quran and the Pauline New Testament. The Torah, prophets, and Psalms, by the way, never make that claim. Never make that claim. Ever. Don't even hint at it. But in the Pauline letters and in the Quran, Satan is constantly bashed, and it's said that anybody who questions the author, Paul or Muhammad's veracity, is of Satan.
Yep.
And so they immediately go to that position. And it was actually by reading Morals and Dogma. I don't know if you guys are familiar with Morals and Dogma, but it's the moral code of Freemasonry. And by reading Morals and Dogma and dealing with what you're finally told as a 33rd degree Mason, and why the Shriners have every sign and symbol of the Shriners is Islamic, is because the Satan, who is the god of Freemasonry, he's the god of every religion, that Satan says, I don't want to. I want to be known as the light bearer. I don't want to be known as Satan. I don't want to be known as the adversary. Satan doesn't want to be respected as the adversary. He doesn't want to be worshipped as the adversary. He wants to be worshipped and seen as God. And the moment you see that, you can see why the Pauline letters and why the Quran demeans Satan and assumes anybody who is contrary to the religion is satanic, is because that is what Satan is trying to avoid. It's what he's trying to disassociate with. It's what he doesn't want known. And so it becomes quite clear that the reason that these lines exist in the Christian New Testament and Paul's letters and in the Quran is Satan wants to be known as the Lord. He wants to be seen as the God, as Allahu Akbar, as Allah is greater and greatest, and not as the adversary, which is what Satan means. And that's one of the reasons why understanding what Hebrew words mean gives great insight to an individual. And, you know, if Satan wasn't known as the adversary, you could say, okay, well, maybe he wants to be worshipped under his title. But no. That is not the case.
Once you got somebody to be afraid of God, you can pretty much tell them whatever you want.
Yep, yep, absolutely. And once you demean
really
God's testimony,
clever on this side of on this side of things, from what I know now, I don't think Paul is that clever. But
no, yeah, I don't either.
If it's ignorant of the Torah, then it's a little.
I had a reason in one of the recent chapters of Observations for Our Time to cite a better part of a chapter of Timothy. I think it was 1 Timothy. And it was written, almost every statement in it had a counterpart in the Quran. So what proves your point is that a satanically inspired individual, Muhammad and Paul, both admitted that they were satanically inspired. You know, read the conclusion of the second letter to the Corinthians. And when you're dealing with Satan, he isn't that clever. He certainly isn't creative. And so it's just one regurgitated corruption after another. And every time, he never comes up with a new creative idea out of whole cloth that says, my idea is such and such, and my idea is better. No, it's always a corruption, a counterfeit, a whitewashing of what God says, because he's looking to gain credibility, right? And he hasn't the ability to conceive something new, something better, so he just simply corrupts and twists and perverts what God has said. That's why the term Babel is so enlightening. It means to twist, to pervert, to corrupt.
And Yahweh didn't make him creative, you know. Well, you know,
no. I don't think he would have been as successful if people didn't if they didn't fear God.
Correct. Yeah. The Quran says, "He who fears will obey."
Mm-hmm.
That's
both Paul and Muhammad were both put in that position. They were both
right. And of course, Paul was extraordinarily threatened.
Oh, yeah.
And so talked about wanting to castrate people. That, you know, if you know, he said that, you know, if you were Torah observant and were in concurrence with God's insistence upon circumcision, then he says, you know, I'd just soon you'd be castrated.
Yep. Yeah. And if anybody, even a Malak, comes with any other message to damn him to hell.
That's right.
Other than his message.
Of course. Yeah, it is amazing. So this goes on to say, with his wing, this his ibra, his winged beans. So it could be with his wing. And, you know, that's, that is a metaphor that Yah uses throughout the Torah, prophets, and Psalms as a mother bird under his wing. Under his wing. But it, but it's also, ibra would be a winged bean. The malak are winged beans. And it means, it's from, ibra is from abar, which means the ability to take flight, to soar, and to ascend to the heavens. And the only difference between abar and ibra is the feminine aspect of Yahweh's nature, describing these spiritual beings. He will cover you, shielding you from attack, and clothe you in a way that promotes your approach and growth. Ha'ak la. He will directly and indirectly provide a suitable defense from attackers, a barricade that makes you inaccessible, forming the protective structure by weaving together the cloth and knitting the threads in the fabric to bring you together with him. It was the hifl yiktol imperfect, which God means that God is empowering those he is assisting such that they are participating in this relationship and so that the results are ongoing, unfolding throughout time. So this is a significant promise. Now, later he's going to say that he is specifically assigning Malak to protect us. But this is his winged beans will cover you. They're going to shield you from attack. They're going to clothe you in such a way that it promotes your approach and your growth. Because we have to approach Yahweh. We have to be in his proximity to convey his message. And we're still flawed. So this is positive from that point of view, but it's also shields us from attack. You know, when I did this, the 3,000 just radio interviews as a guest, an expert guest on Islam, I did 2,998 of them the same way. And the deal I made with Yahweh specifically was, I'll prepare, I'll be ready. I will do the research, I will be willing to talk to anyone, anywhere, bluntly and boldly on this subject. But because there are debate fallacies, rhetoric fallacies, that render evidence and reason moot amongst those in an audience who don't understand rhetoric, who are unfamiliar with logic, the deal that I made was that that he would preclude those kinds of interviews. Because all I was going to do, I was prepared to approach the subject of Muhammad, Allah, and Islam using evidence and reason. But if somebody says, hey, I know a Muslim, and that Muslim's a nice guy, and I can't believe that that all Muslims are terrorists, and they go on to this, you're being hateful. They take that approach. It appeals to an ignorant audience. And they have no idea that it has no bearing whatsoever on the evidence, and it's not rational. And so I did 2,998 interviews in a row. But anyone taking that most popular approach to dismissing evidence and reason. Then I had two in a row where that was the host's entire diatribe, and they were just mean and hateful about it. And so I went to God and said, you know, we had a deal. These last two interviews fell outside of that deal. And he said, they did. That is correct. I said, I mean, we must be over. Oh, but we're just beginning. We were over with Islam. We had done, there was nothing more to say. You know, I had said it. I had written it. There was nothing more to say. There was nothing more to be done. That job, that mission was completed. And we were off to a new mission, which is when Yada Yah began. So this idea of providing a defense, you know, I did hundreds of debates and thousands of shows. He was always there with the right thing to say at the right time. So this goes on to say, so under his wing, by way of his winged beans, he will cover you, shielding you from attack and clothe you in a way that promotes your approach and your growth. And under his wings, the extremity of his garments, and in his corner, kanaf can be any one of those three things. It can mean speak of apparel. It can speak of wings. It can speak of his messengers. It can speak of being in his corner, like in the case of a fighter. You will rest. His reliable and dependable nature upon you is a large shield to keep you cool and collected. You know what it's like to speak words that no one wants to hear? And to have angry people condemning you when you try to do it, who know nothing. They're just slandering politically correct jargon and opinions, and never once losing your cool, not in 3,000 hours of doing this. You know, I think that in the Blog Talk Radio before Shattering Myths, which was like 4 years, and then the 3 years of Shattering Myths, and then the time since, I think I only lost my cool once.
I remember.
Once. Man, there's a lot of stupid things people said. Only once. And I lost my my cool. It was I don't even remember what the subject was, but what I recall is that I was talking to somebody promoting Pauline Christianity, and you would point out something that God said that was in conflict with their religion, and rather than acknowledging that, they just go on and restate their statement. Then you'd say, well, your statement is disproved by God in him saying such and such. And then they would continue to restate their statement. And you go, and you do this like five times, and you say, you know, I'm beating my head against the wall.
Yeah.
Yeah, enough already. And so, you know, that's I think that that's one of the things that God wants to convey. He wants us to be cool under fire. You know, you look at Yosha. Yosha was really sharp. He had a sharp tongue. He was blunt. He was bold. You know, this this lovey-dovey, we shouldn't use hate speech. And his speech was laced with hate. Laced with hate. He hated the religious establishment. He hated the militaristic establishment. He hated the Romans. I mean, he hated them.
Yeah.
And he spoke. He let them have it.
But you know, the words he spoke,
but he was always cool. Always cool under fire.
You know, like, what do you say to a religious person that's all puffed up and has got a swelled head?
Yeah.
It's kind of it's a shock method, but you know, he's still compassionate, even though he let him have it, like, he just,
you know,
laid out one liners that they couldn't, there was no answer to.
He did, though, something that I found that I had to do. And the only time I didn't do it is when I lost my cool the one time in all of these, you know, 7,000-8,000 hours of radio talk, is that every time that he engaged people, he would engage two or three people. He would, you know, say, listen, I'm going to do this for you, but only so that you'd have an appreciation that I have the power to do much more than this. And you're interested in your body, and I can do this for your soul. And that's the only reason I'm doing it. And, you know, and he would, they'd ask him questions, and he'd say, why are you asking me that question? The question has been answered for you. You know, what does it say? And, you know, and even like the guys to Emmaus, on the road to Emmaus, he said, you guys are just idiots. How come you can't figure this out? I mean, this is what it says in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. Can't you make the connection? But you know what he did 100% of the time? He would have contact with one or two, the most three people. And even just for short bursts, and then he'd walk away. He'd go away so that they didn't even know where he was. He would just disappear from them. So rather than constantly trying to engage them and engaging them in an ongoing dialogue, he'd give them both barrels, say what he had to say, and he was gone.
Yeah, there's really, like, when you're a Christian, there's all this anxiety about, you know, delivering people from hell, and it's a totally different scenario in that, you know, like, you have mortal life, there's destruction, and there's, you know,
I think it's part of this. I never thought of it this way before. I always thought of it, Jason, as that is that that too much of man's rhetoric would just wear you down. It gets to be depressing. It gets you nowhere. A man gets all wrapped up and things. But I think maybe that the answer is something along the lines of what you're saying, which is that if you're God, if you take it from his perspective, the only way to actually get to know him and to understand what he's offering so that you can respond to the terms and conditions of his covenant and meet with him on his seven invitations to meet and be called out. The only way to do that is to quietly and with great diligence turn to his Torah, prophets, and Psalms and study them, think about them, and with an open mind, make the connection so that you come to know, understand, so that you're able to trust and rely. And that can't be done if you're engaging in debate.
Debate can be okay, I think, as long as, because, you know, like,
Can you name a single debate that Yahweh engaged in?
Well, I mean, there was debates between Yahusha. Yahweh uses rhetorical questions at times.
Yeah, I don't see.
I don't see a question. When he's appealing to somebody's intellect. But
yeah, I just don't see him engaging
in debate. There's no anxiety involved in it.
You know? I think he engaged in very brief question and answer. They would be asked a question, he would provide an answer. But debate?
Yeah.
He would not be lured into debate.
I understand what you mean now. It's not debate in that you're not, like, it's not your goal to convince somebody of something.
No.
It's more like laying it out, take it or leave it.
Right.
And so the person who is, under the shelter of, observing the Torah, There's no obligation there for them. They're not, like, they're still liberated, even though they're in the midst of, Babylon, so.
Correct. So this is God saying, I'm going to cover you. I'm going to promote you. I'm going to put you in my corner. You're going to be adorned with my garments. And it's my reliable nature that's going to be a shield that keeps you cool and collected. And it's this is all because he says that his steadfast, consistent, and firm and reliable nature is a valuable defender.
In the first verse, in the translations, he uses the word shadow. Mm-hmm. And I always thought that was a reference to when Israel was leaving Egypt. But when I'm looking at the word here, I don't see a reference to it in Exodus.
I think that when God talks about in the shadow, the Salem is the word, and it means in the likeness. So
is it the same word that's used in image?
Yes. Yeah, it's an image. It's an image word.
Yeah.
It's the word that appears in the first statement of this psalm. God's saying that for those who trust and rely on him by name and who seek to live with him in his shelter, that they will be made in his image. So it's in the first statement of Psalm 91. Now, it goes on to say, I saw my mighty one dwelling upon brief interlude. I really should have prefaced this. I really was trying to define now this word, because this is a very interesting word. Is God telling us that twice that he's got us under his wings, because you have Ebra, which is winged beings, and Kanaf, which is primarily translated wings. But there's places where it's translated the extremity of his gardens and other garments, and other places where it's translated in his corner, like in a boxing match where you'd be in your corner.